loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a second pro-democratic false flag operation has been revealed in Alabama. The New York Times reported today that progressive activists set up a fake social media page that appeared to come from Alabama evangelicals, falsely representing that Republican Roy Moore would make Alabama dry. The single state operation cost another $100,000 over 2 weeks. That's the amount that the Internet Research Agency spent nationwide in the 2016 election. Meanwhile, the sonic attacks, so-called sonic attacks in Cuba, that were supposed to be from Russia, have now been attributed to very loud crickets. Next, four Republican senators led by Marco Rubio of Florida last week sponsored a bill that would seek to criminalize the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS movement. It would also impose harsh sanctions on Syria and increase military aid to Israel and Egypt. The bill has broad bipartisan support in the Senate and will be called to an expedited vote as early as today. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, a Democrat, said that he will seek to push the bill through the House. Then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today we talk about the Los Angeles teachers who plan to strike on Thursday. And then today we enter day 17 of the partial government shutdown, already the second longest in American history. President Trump is threatening to upend negotiations with Congress by declaring a national emergency that would allow him to build his border wall while completely bypassing Congress. Negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over the weekend did not yield any results. And finally, Jim Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, was forced to rescind an invitation to the head of the Russian space agency to visit the United States after the offer was criticized by key senators. Space historically has been a point on which the U.S. and Russia have cooperated, but is this cancellation yet another sign of a dangerous arms race leading to the militarization of space? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to another false flag operation in Alabama. A second pro-democratic false flag operation has been revealed in Alabama. The New York Times reported today that progressive activists set up a fake social media page that appeared to come from Alabama evangelicals, falsely representing that Republican Roy Moore would make Alabama dry. The single state operation cost another $100,000 over 2 weeks. That's the amount that the Internet Research Agency spent nationwide in the 2016 election. Meanwhile, the sonic attacks, so-called sonic attacks in Cuba, that were supposed to be from Russia, have now been attributed to very loud crickets. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Where do you even start on something like this? First of all, this false flag operation, what was interesting in Scott Shane's article in the New York Times is that his primary source, who was named, was the guy in charge of this false flag operation, and he was very happily bragging about its success.
Yes, he was. He thought it was the moral thing to do because he presumed the Republicans were doing the same thing. But to me, the whole thing sort of strikes me as a case of a psychological projection, you know, where you attribute your own base motives to the opposing person. So the Democrats assume the Republicans are up to dirty tricks, and therefore they feel entitled to engage in dirty tricks of their own. And of course, since the Russians started it, everyone feels free to blame the Russians and even try to pass the blame onto them via various false flag operations.
Yeah, the person you were talking about who constructed this operation, this was $100,000 of social media, Facebook, false Facebook posts in Alabama 2 weeks before the election. Now, the Internet Research Agency, indicted by Robert Mueller, was accused of spending $100,000 over the course of the entire campaign. And John, also after the campaign, as a matter of fact, 56% of the $100,000 came after the November 2016 election. So they spent $44,000 sometime in 2015 and 2016, and almost no ads were about a candidate who was running for office. They were about what was called socially divisive issues. Right? Abortion rights, black rights, gun rights, et cetera, et cetera. But The New York Times, Daniel Lazar, according to what they tell us in this article, revealing that there was the second operation by Democratic Party operatives that spent $100,000 in a 2-week period on top of the other $100,000 that New Knowledge spent before the special race in Alabama for one seat in one state. The New York Times is telling us, oh, this was a small operation, wouldn't have a big impact. Well, if it didn't have a big impact there, that would suggest that the Russians, if the Russians in fact did something, would have almost no impact or zero impact.
Right.
Well, yes, in terms of votes cast, the 2016 presidential election was almost exactly 100 times as large as the Alabama special election in 2017. So the Internet Research Agency spent half as much money over a much longer period in an election that was 100 times as large as these two operations did in Alabama. So that's a lot of money, and it's a very close race, and certainly it's reasonable to suspect that they actually did alter the outcome. I mean, Doug Jones won by only 20,000 votes.
Matt Osborne, the Democratic Party, quote, progressive activist, a label that I think should be taken away, said the stats he was given on the reach of the face of the brief Facebook operation, the 2 weeks, $100,000, were impressive. He said 4.6 million views of his Facebook posts, these are fake posts, and 97,000 engagements, for instance, liking or sharing posts. That's a lot. 97,000 likes or shares.
Yep.
Simple videos pushing the message, dry Alabama, were watched 430,000 times in that 2-week period, according to Matt Osborne, the architect. Now, what they were telling, these were messages that were targeted to conservative Republicans, in particular, business people whose businesses would be influenced if Alabama suddenly went dry, meaning you can't buy liquor in the state, you can't buy beer, you can't buy wine. They were hoping that these conservative Alabamians who might vote for Roy Moore would not vote for Roy Moore if they thought Roy Moore would somehow make Alabama a dry state, which would hurt their businesses.
And, you know, if you have half a brain, you know that that's not a federal issue. And so Roy Moore being elected to the Senate can't make Alabama dry, even if he wanted to.
Right. But okay. You use the half brain criteria.
Yes.
But let's just think about people, how they react on social media.
Oh, sure. They react without thinking.
Yeah. Roy Moore wants to make this a dry state. He's a lunatic. I supported him because I'm a Republican. He's a Republican, blah, blah, blah. But if Roy Moore is going to make it a dry state, that's going to actually hurt my business. I might not vote for Roy Moore. I might stay home, or I might actually vote for Doug Jones, or I might vote for the independent write-in who is actually being promoted by another Democratic Party operative. In this case, New Knowledge. I could see how this could have an influence.
Especially compacted into that 2-week period.
And here again, they said initially, the New York Times said that these kind of operations were imitating Russian tactics. Daniel Lazar, you sort of made the assumption that the Democratic Party operatives thought, well, the Republicans are doing it or the Russians are doing it, so we should do it too. We have a moral imperative to do it for our side. But actually, that's an assumption on our part. We don't actually know whether they truly believed the Republicans were doing this. Maybe they were. I wouldn't doubt it. But they might have just thought this was a clever way of influencing the election outcome.
Well, yes. But actually, one of the people involved in this operation was quoted as saying that he believed the Republicans were doing this up to the same dirty tricks. And therefore, he felt a moral imperative to do the same. So everyone's blaming everyone else. But I think this is really a serious business. And I think it's a good chance, a reasonable chance, the election was thrown. When you do that, when you throw an election in a democratic country, that's a supposedly democratic country, that's a really serious affair. That shouldn't happen. And this should, you know, and getting to the root of this should be a top priority.
Yeah, Doug Jones has actually called for an investigation of New Knowledge for the earlier fake operations that they conducted against Roy Moore. Let's turn to another subject again, because this sort of goes to the heart of the Russiagate stuff, because the Democrats and maybe the Republicans are doing what Robert Mueller indicted the Internet Research Agency for doing on the basis that it was Russia coming in a big way to influence the outcome, and it impacted the outcome of the 2016 election. There was another part of the hysteria. Donald Trump, you know, shut down, basically shut down big parts of the U.S. embassy in Havana. And there's been this big crusade about the fact that American diplomats were targeted with sonic weapons, either by maybe hardline Cubans, maybe it was the Russians, of course, because, you know, why not if there was a problem with the U.S. embassy? Maybe it was the Chinese. But now we find, according to a new study that the New York Times wrote about, the sounds that haunted U.S. diplomats in Cuba, lovelorn crickets, scientists say.
Well, particularly loud, lovelorn crickets.
Yeah. They were crickets of a particular type. They listened to the recording that the American diplomats said showed that they were being impacted by strange noises. And they say, Daniel Azar, it was the crickets.
Yes, there was a study, which a very clever study, which analyzed one recording. And it seems to be that the sound that some people thought was causing this ear damage was actually made by a certain variety of Caribbean cricket, which apparently can be extraordinarily noisy when in the throes of mating and love and et cetera, et cetera. So it's really embarrassing for the Americans, obviously, and we still have no idea of what, if anything, caused this ear damage. There apparently was some ear damage among some individuals, but we have no idea what caused it, and we certainly have no evidence whatsoever that it was done by the Russians, the Cubans, or the Chinese.
Maybe Russian intelligence trained crickets. Maybe they were doing like the Red Army choir singing. That's probably what it was. It was probably crickets who were singing in Russian. But anyway, the serious part of the story is that in the midst of this other hysteria about what happened to the American diplomats, maybe something else did hurt them. We don't really know.
Yeah, some of them have actual traumatic brain injury and some of them had concussions.
We don't know what the story is, but the fact that it came out that it was crickets, yeah, is the recording they were pointing to, the strange noise. Again, we have a breakdown in U.S.-Cuban relations that the Trump administration used over this issue in particular.
We sure do. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Azar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Four Republican senators led by Marco Rubio of Florida last week sponsored a bill that would seek to criminalize the boycott, divestment, sanctions, or BDS movement. It would also impose harsh sanctions on Syria and increase military aid to Israel and Egypt. The bill has broad bipartisan support in the Senate and will be called to an expedited vote as early as today. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, a Democrat, said that he will seek to push the bill through the House. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Miko, this bill does a bunch of different things. It gives state and local governments explicit legal authority to boycott any U.S. companies which themselves are boycotting Israel. That's a first-time thing. It imposes harsh sanctions on Syria and on Syrian government officials, not that they would be traveling to the United States anyway. It increases military spending specifically to the Middle East or in the Middle East. And indeed, it's called the National Security and Defense of America in the Middle East Act, which is a very odd name. Most importantly, though, is this BDS component. It seems like it would chill free speech. It seems like it would probably be unconstitutional, but it's got this broad bipartisan support. There are as many Democrats as there are Republicans behind it. What do you think?
Well, I was encouraged this morning to see Bernie Sanders tweeting that it is unconstitutional and that it infringes on the constitutional rights of people to protest whatever they want to protest in whichever way they wish to do so. So that was good. And it's, this was a top legislative priority for AIPAC. And we know that the White House is following political priorities of Benjamin Netanyahu. And now, obviously, the Senate is doing the same. They're competing with the White House and who is more supportive of Benjamin Netanyahu's foreign policy, you know, the White House or the Senate. I mean, this is what's happening here. It's absolutely outrageous. It's absolutely absurd. And I think we're getting into a very interesting time in the U.S. House of Representatives, at least, with at least two representatives who are openly supportive of BDS and a few others who are maybe not supportive but understand that it's a First Amendment issue. So we're going to have to wait and see. I think this is a very important fight for all of us who believe in free speech and oppose racism and apartheid in Palestine. This is a really important fight for us to stand up and fight.
We're speaking with Miko Peled. He joins us from Washington. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and also of Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Hey, I saw a tweet this morning from Ileana Roslightnin, the former congresswoman from Miami who was the chairwoman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And she was cheering on this bill, saying, yay, even though I'm not in Congress anymore, my bill lives on. And that tweet was retweeted by Dick Durbin, a Democratic senator from Illinois.
American democracy gives the appearance of variety.
Well, you know, Israel is a bipartisan issue. It's always been a bipartisan issue. Support for Israel and the following APEX rules and following APEX political agenda has always been a bipartisan issue. You know, I think I was at the Capitol the day that of the swearing in last Thursday, and I visited several offices, but particularly Rashida Tlaib's office and Ilhan Omar's office. And you know, obviously, this is a Senate bill. You know, I'm talking about the House of Representatives, but I think it seems to me that for the first time we may have a fighting chance. I mean, I don't know that it's going to be as easy to pass this as it seems as it used to be. And again, it's a fighting chance. In other words, it's not like, you know, things have changed dramatically.
Sure.
But if we stand up and fight this and expose this, and I would add to that also, I would hope that Betty McCollum's bill about the detention of Palestinian children comes back. I don't know what it's going to be called, you know, this time around. And members of Congress and members of the Senate are going to have to explain why they can't support a bill that calls for the protection of minors. So, we you know, there's a lot of tough battles coming up, and I think we need to use whatever we have. And right now, it seems that we have a few voices at the Capitol that we can work with, and we need to fight this and expose this for the corruption, for the mafia style politics that it is.
Why wasn't this bill passed in the last Congress?
That's a very good question. I think it's not such an easy thing to pass anymore. I don't think it's quite as easy. I mean, obviously there's the First Amendment issue, which many people still feel very strongly about, and I think that helps. I think the question of Palestine and is not the way it isn't viewed as it used to. I think the members of the House of Representatives and the Senate are realizing that perhaps their constituents are not as clearly one-sided and supportive as Israel as they used to be, and that they might pay a price if they pass this.
You know, I went to the trouble of looking at the individual websites of these senators, Joe Manchin, Marco Rubio, and Cory Gardner, others who have sponsored it in the Senate. Gardner's was the most troublesome. Here's what he said. I'm proud to sponsor this legislation, which enhances our alliances in the Middle East, condemns the heinous human rights abuses of the Assad regime, and takes a strong stance against the anti-Israel and anti-Semitic BDS movement. So that's the new narrative, is that this is anti-Semitic, that if you support Palestinian human rights or you support fairness or equality in Israel, you're anti-Semitic. That's what it's come to.
Yes, I don't know if this is a new narrative. This is, you know, Chuck Schumer has been saying this for quite some time, that, you know, BDS is some kind of a new and sophisticated type of anti-Semitism. And of course, the question is, like you point out, you know, BDS calls for justice, for equality, for freedom. And is Chuck Schumer saying that those values are incompatible with Judaism? Because if he is saying that, anybody who says that BDS is anti-Semitic himself. Because freedom and justice and equality can perfectly be characterized as Jewish values. So what is the problem here? Where is the anti-Semitism? And of course, there's no answer to that, because they expect that once they throw out the anti-Semitism card, everybody will shut up and cower. And I don't think that's going to happen this time. I think they're going to have a very tough fight. I mean, I hope they're going to have a very tough fight. And again, if we stand up and use what we have right now, like I said, Bernie Sanders came out against it this morning. He called it an attempt to punish Americans who exercise their constitutional right to engage in political activity. And of course, Rashida Tlaib came out against it as well. So we need to, you know, all join forces and fight this thing because this is the fight. I think that the closer we get to the point where Palestinian rights do become universally recognized, and the fight against apartheid in Palestine becomes more becomes broader in terms of the public and public acceptance, then the tougher this fight's going to be. But we're going to have to stand up and be there and fight.
Miko Peled is our guest. Miko, I was just thinking back to when this new legislation was introduced, to what happened to Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, you know, here you have members of the Senate, and all of them, all the members of the Senate, Republican or Democrat, all the members of the House, they're gonna pay tribute these days to Martin Luther King Jr. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested by Birmingham Sheriff Bull Connor, who had obtained an injunction from a state judge. They had 133 movement leaders arrested, including Martin Luther King, for what? Quote, parading, demonstrating, boycotting, trespassing, and picketing. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote that famous letter from a Birmingham jail, that famous letter that everybody now puts on a pedestal and says, this is a testament to America and what America stands for and how America can evolve. He was in jail for boycotting. He was in jail for boycotting against racist, discriminatory laws in the South. He was put in prison in jail by Bull Connor, none other than racist, fascist, Birmingham Sheriff Bull Connor. And again, here we are, 2018. People are being treated the same way. And these congressmen, these senators and congresswomen, we're not Bull Connor. We're in the 21st century. We're urbane. But it's the same thing in essence. Go ahead.
Well, I think if Martin Luther King Jr. was alive and active today, he would be called both an anti-Semite and a terrorist. There's absolutely no question about that. And the Bull Connors are now sitting in the Senate. And I don't think things have changed quite that dramatically. I think the changes that have taken place are mostly cosmetic. And this is the proof, you know, this is the proof that, you know, today that there are members of the United States Senate that want to punish people for boycotting, and never mind boycotting, but boycotting a state that is inherently racist, the practice is apartheid, that is engaged in the brutal killing and oppression of an entire nation. You know, I mean, very, very little has changed, I think, in essence. And again, if Martin Luther King, and they did kill, I mean, Martin Luther King was eventually killed. So, you know, I don't think that's a big surprise. But had he been alive today, there's no question that he would have been labeled anti-Semitic and a terrorist.
Yeah. And John, Bernie Sanders' tweet not only was correct in his statement about the Bill of Rights and the right to speak out and the right to boycott against a racist apartheid state, he also made the point that it's somewhat absurd that the first bill during the government shutdown is legislation which punishes Americans for exercising their constitutional rights. I mean, really something. But all of these politicians bow before the altar of Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean,
they all do.
Amazing. Anyway,
we're out of time there, unfortunately. We were joined from Washington by Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He's also the author of a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. Bill joins us from Maine. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Nice to hear your voices, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bill. Boy, huge, huge news on the horizon. It looks like the Los Angeles school district is going to go on strike this week, and that means 900 schools, 30,000 teachers, and 600,000 students would be affected.
It's about time in a certain sense. I mean, teachers, as we've talked about many times, teachers across the country are standing up, not just for their own rights and their own profession, but standing up for the rights of children. And it really is a right of every child to have a decent, fully competent education. And if it's a human right, that means they ought to have competent, well-paid teachers, forward-looking curriculum, decent facilities, the arts, music, all the rest of it. And so the teachers in Los Angeles, very much like the teachers in Chicago 5 years ago, and the teachers in West Virginia and Colorado and Arizona, are saying enough is enough. If you don't believe in public education, stand up and say so. But if you believe in it, then you have to pay us a decent wage so that we're not driving Ubers and waiting tables in order to get supplies for our kids. So I think it's about time. I think it's an important strike. I think everyone should rally and support it as best they can, because teachers in LA have been underpaid for years all over California. And the main people who suffer, of course, are the kids. But as I've said many times, you can't have good working conditions. I mean, good teaching conditions without good working conditions. And good teaching conditions are good learning conditions. So this is all linked. And I think it's a very important move by the LA teachers.
The New York Times reporting on this story today writes, "The impending strike highlights the fact that despite California's reputation as a center of liberal policy, it spends relatively little on public education. School spending levels, about $11,000 per student in 2016, are far below those in other blue bastions. For example, California spends about half as much as New York on the average child."
Crazy. I had no idea that was the case.
Well, I mean, that's part of the equation, and there's other ways we can balance those statistics and see what's going on. California spends $11,000 per student in their public schools. How much do they pay per prisoner in their vast prison system that stretches the length of the state? In Illinois, which I know better, over a 30-year period, we paid much more to construct prisons than we did to construct universities or colleges. That says volumes about where we're headed as a society. It is nothing short of social suicide to do what we've done in Chicago, which is close schools and use $95 million to build a police academy. That is a recipe for disaster. And that's what the California teachers are standing up and saying, enough. We don't want to live this way. This is not the society we imagine or want to fight for.
I just did a little quick search to find out how much it does cost California to house a prisoner. It's $11,000 per student, right?
That's right.
It costs an average of about $71,000 per year to incarcerate an inmate in prison in California.
And that's double what it costs the federal government for federal prisoners.
Yeah. So $11,000 for a student, $71,000 for an inmate.
Incredible.
You know, I had no idea it was that bad. I knew it was bad. I mean, because when I last looked at this, I had written a book called A Kind and Just Parent about children in juvenile detention. And it costs more to keep a 14 or 15-year-old in juvenile detention in Chicago than it costs to send him to Lake Forest Academy or Deerfield Academy or one of the Tony prep schools. It costs more to imprison them than send them to the best prep schools in the Midwest. That is insane. And that's the kind of calculus that we have to do in order to understand that our priorities are way, way out of whack. And we need to really build a movement to change that.
Bill Ayers, one of these stories, another story that you flagged for us before we did this show, and we talk about different pieces that we might talk about each week. One is about Native kids in Colorado. Talk about what that story is.
Well, what's happened, the New York Times did a great investigative report on what happened in a small Indian school district in Colorado. And what they discovered is should be no surprise, but the details were not so much shocking as they were disheartening and despicable. What you see is Native kids who are singled out, not given special ed services, channeled into the worst classes with no viable outcome for either going on to higher education or having a job. Now, the reason this isn't surprising is it dates back to the treatment of indigenous people from the beginning. And, you know, Native boarding schools, the so-called Indian boarding schools, only disappeared you know, a couple of decades ago. We know many people out in California who were seized from their families and sent to those schools. Those were the schools that were to beat the culture out of you, beat the language out of you, get you prepared to be on the lowest rung of white society. And that system disappeared. But in the guise of decent public schools, we see, again, a tract system where Native kids get the worst, have the worst outcomes, have no opportunity for advancement or even for access to the kind of curriculum that would give them an opening into either work or higher education.
Bill, before we started recording this segment, you mentioned to us that you are reading a new biography of Frederick Douglass. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, have you seen it's by David Blight. I don't know if you've seen it.
It's quite well received.
Oh my God, the reviews have been stunning. And friends gave it to me for my birthday a week ago. And I don't usually pick up a book that's 800 pages long, but I dived into it and I've been unable to put it down. I'm not finished with it yet, but it is really something. And the reason it came to my mind is, you know, the very deep theme of Frederick Douglass's life is the idea that education is a road toward freedom. For him, you know, learning to read, which he had his master's wife surreptitiously taught him to read. And when the master found out, he blew up and said, "You can't teach him to read. It will unfit him to be a slave." And that's a metaphor that still rings true today. If you're an educated person, the ability to not only decipher language, but to make sense of the world, you are unfit to be the slave of anybody. And Frederick Douglass returns to that theme again and again. He was a giant, and not only in the 19th century, probably throughout American history, his story is so extraordinary. And he wrote three memoirs about his life, three autobiographies, all of which are worth reading. But this book puts them together and really shows you that for an enslaved, young, bright, ambitious, hardworking, strong guy, there was nothing more valuable to him than education. And when he escaped from slavery, he escaped from from Baltimore and got up to New Bedford, Massachusetts. And his first task really became to educate other people who were enslaved, other workers, because he knew that that was the pathway to imagining a better life and then to fight for a better life.
Bill Ayers is our guest. Bill is a famed educator, an award-winning educator. He's written numerous books. One of his books, a recent book he's the co-author of, is You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Bill, we have about 2 minutes left. Time always goes so fast. You're starting to teach a new class called Teach Freedom. Let's talk about that.
I'm always excited at the beginning of any term, any class. I've been a teacher since 1965, and like every other teacher I know, the first couple of days of class are always times of anxiety because you can't just put yourself on automatic pilot. It always depends on who shows up, and the biggest task of teaching is to unlock the wisdom in the room. But kids have signed up for this class called Teach Freedom, and we're going to be reading some just terrific texts. We're reading Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. You probably know that book. I'm sure you do. But you may not know Maxine Green's book, The Dialectic of Freedom. We'll be reading that. We'll be reading from my book, Demand the Impossible. And then we're going to read Barbara Ransby's unbelievably important book, All Black Lives Matter. So these are some of the readings we're going to do. But the real conversation is going to be about the ways in which freedom is understood in this country and the ways in which we could deepen an understanding. One of the things I asked my students on the very first day is to write, just do a short free write on the word freedom. And invariably, because they're Americans, because they're privileged to be in college, the writing tends to be about personal freedom, my freedom, what I'm allowed to do. And it takes us a while to bend towards the notion that freedom isn't just a personal matter, it's a social matter. And so when you think of the liberation movements of the 20th century, the Black Freedom Movement, the Women's Movement, these were always about freedom for a people. wasn't just about individuals. It was about the right of people to overcome the obstacles that have been put in their way because they are African-American or because they're female or because they're queer. And so a lot of what we're going to do in this class is wrestle with the question of social freedom. I don't know if you all have seen Boots Riley's new film, Sorry to Bother You. One of the wonderful tropes in that film is there's a corporation lurking in the background called Worry Free. And it's advertised in this kind of Disneyland way for a consumer society. Sign up now for Worry Free. You won't have to pay your bills. We'll pay them. You won't have to worry about food. We'll feed you. You won't have to worry about housing. We'll house you. The one catch is you have to sign a lifetime work contract. So it's slavery for the modern age, but all under the guise of freedom. And this is what part of what we're talking about in this class is to complicate the word freedom. It's important to remember that the abolitionists during the Civil War and before were fighting for freedom, but the slave owners were fighting for freedom too. They were going to burn down the whole house for the singular freedom, my right to own another human being. And that's freedom too. So we have to kind of not just get all gauzy about it. We have to think hard about what it means and how we can participate in a movement for real freedom for all.
Very, very, very important point. Not the freedom to exploit, but the freedom to be free from exploitation. And again, everybody should see the movie Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley, that great, great movie. And everybody should also go to Bill Ayers' blog, www.billayers.org, to read all of Bill's writings, and also to find out how you can get his books. But John, we're out of time.
We're out of time. Bill Ayers joined us from Maine. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. He's also the author of many other books. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we enter day 17 of the partial government shutdown, already the second longest in American history. President Trump is threatening to upend negotiations with Congress by declaring a national emergency that would allow him to build his border wall while completely bypassing Congress. Negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over the weekend did not yield any results. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. Welcome back, Juan Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to start with this notion of national emergency. There is no national emergency. This is a manufactured emergency. In fact, border crossings are lower now than they were under President Obama. But the president is threatening to formally declare a national emergency, in which case he can assume, well, dictatorial powers, at least enough to force construction of this border wall. What do you think about that?
I think it does have all the underlines of a fascist government. I was just sharing with some people, you know, that when there is no balances, check and balances, not only in the immigration field, you know, we got to pay attention to what's going on here. It's not just this shutdown, the government shutdown is so irresponsible. And it really, you know, we have seen this already, this deterioration of democratic values within the immigration field, where there is no any monitoring whatsoever. There are no check and balances. And now it is expanding, okay? And yeah, it is a manufacturing crisis. Now it all seems that executive branch of government has all the power to do whatever they want and whenever they want it, whatever he wants and whatever he wants. So we really need to check, to push back, I think, in many fronts, because I think what is pillar of this democracy is being demolished completely.
I was surprised to see also over the weekend, TSA officers in airports, they are, of course, part of the shutdown, so they're not being paid, and they've begun calling in sick in large numbers, which has just jammed up the airports because there aren't enough people to process passengers through security. That's just one small aspect of this shutdown. I wanted to talk to you about another thing too, and that is some of the camps, they're not even really camps, I guess, they're detention facilities where where immigrants are being held. I saw a report from the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, that said that the company that's in charge of medical care at these detention sites, it's called Correct Care Solutions, has been sued in federal court 1,395 times in the last decade. That's the company that's providing medical care to immigrants.
Once again, we talk about the no oversight, the not monitoring, the not check and balances. If you look into this immigration manufacturer crisis that has been, you know, has been really put forth by our president, you notice that, you know, within these gulags, there is no any such thing as human rights. There is no any sense of that anymore. Most of these companies, and most of these detention centers are in the hands of private companies. I think it's at 75% throughout the nation. So you have people doing whatever they want, just basically violating the human rights of these people, of the immigrants. And when, you know, when we equate citizenship with either that person is a citizen and does have rights, or he's not a citizen or she's not a citizen and that therefore doesn't have rights. You know, we are regressing to another time, which is really detrimental to the whole of society. It's really outrageous and immoral to believe, you know, that we are walking towards this goal of democracy and fulfilling the destiny of this nation. I mean, we are really rapidly witnessing the erosion of what we value most, which is, you know, this democratic society that, you know, our forefathers and our foremothers have built from ages on.
Juan Carlos, over the weekend, Democrats and Republicans made no progress in these budget negotiations. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican of South Carolina, complained that the Republicans were represented by senators and congressmen in these talks. They were chaired by Vice President Pence. The Democrats were represented by crazy people and staff members. And he was complaining that until the Democrats begin to take this seriously, there will be no agreement to reopen the budget. The Democrats, on the other hand, say that they're taking this very seriously, but they're concerned about this wall and they're concerned about this ultimatum that the president has placed on the entire process, that without a wall, there will be no budget. What happens next?
I think they are onto something. The framework has to change. It has to be an openness and a dialogue, you know, to dialogue and to really, you know, politicize this issue in a way that can bring some kind of fruits that will help, you know, this stalemate. I think we need to begin with the facts. You know, there is a bunch of lies just flying around. And when you begin from that, you know, from that sense of manufactured crisis, emergency, and don't really look at the facts of what's going on, because we know, you know, that there is already a virtual wall. The people that are coming into our country unauthorized, it's a trickle of, you know, of years past. We have to look at this more comprehensively and more holistically. I mean, we have to look at the, you know, why do we have in our midst 12 plus million people still undocumented after 3 decades, you know, without amnesty, without any kind of resolution? I think we need to declare, I mean, maybe basically say, you know, let's take the next 30 days to basically come to the table and really offer solutions.
That's an important point. This is not a new problem. This is immigration is not an issue that has just popped up and has posed a problem for the government. I mean, Woody Guthrie was writing songs about immigration and about deportations, what, 80 years ago?
That's exactly right, John. And, you know, we have, as our guest is explaining, a manufactured crisis. Last year, the Democrats said they would give $20 billion to Trump for a wall, which was ridiculous, in exchange for him reversing his executive order that denied relief to the Dreamers, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, kids who came to this country when their family didn't yet have papers, and they still don't have papers, so they're living in the shadows. Clearly, Trump did this on purpose. He wanted to, you know, have this shut down because he wanted to make the point that he was standing up against the Democrats, and the Democrats were for open borders. Juan Carlos is right. Also, in the United States, you go to Ellis Island in New York City. As many as 15 million people came through there, mainly from Europe. They were there for a day or two. They didn't have papers. They were given papers. If they had a family member in the United States, if they didn't have smallpox, they were let in. You have the Statue of Liberty right there in New York Harbor. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. This was the whole sort of the mantra of America about what made America different. It was a melting pot. But now you have Trump. And it's not just Trump, but because the immigrants are coming from the South, they're coming from Latin America, they're being demonized. They're coming for the exact same reason that Europeans came 100 years ago.
And that's right. We got to point out, it's not just Trump. We have a system that has been injected with billions and billions of dollars and that has been on steroids right after 9/11, you know, and you know, it has literally closed the doors to refugees and to people who are seeking to breathe free. You know, I think we got to take that into consideration when what kind of a country are we, you know, when people still believe in those ideals and they are still coming here because, you know, as you pointed out clearly, you know, our ancestors came because of that also, because they're looking for a better way of living. And, you know, North America does have that. Therefore, I mean, they are not wrong. You know, so how do we manage this flow of immigration? And to the point, you know, or really coming to the table and having meaningful civil conversations. I think it's being irresponsible to manufacture this crisis. I think there has to be the willingness and the political craftiness for people to come and offer a real solution. I don't think to give away more money, just, I mean, you know, the notion is that we have these unlimited resources to put on these security apparatus. That doesn't work. You know, we have ample evidence the last 30 years, you know, it's not just the medical treatment of immigrants. But you talk about the sexual abuse, you know, they intercept a few months back. Talk about over, you know, in a span of 5 years, you know, these detention centers have received complaints over, you know, 5,000 cases or, you know, of sexual abuse, sexual harassment.
It's true. I've actually written about this. This is an ongoing problem that the government has tried to cover up, actually. And it's not just immigrants preying on other immigrants. It's actually staff members and medical personnel preying on people. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jim Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, was forced to rescind an invitation to the head of the Russian Space Agency to visit the United States after the offer was criticized by key senators. Space historically has been a point on which the U.S. and Russia have cooperated, but is this cancellation yet another sign of a dangerous arms race leading to the militarization of space? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York, college at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Professor, welcome.
A pleasure to be with you.
We're very happy to have you. What do you think? With the announcement of the Space Force and now this the rescission of this invitation, do you think that we're headed down this path toward a militarization of space?
Very easily. The path for international cooperation in space was really set forth and goes way back to 1967 and the Outer Space Treaty, which sets space aside for peaceful purposes. And the three countries that were the leaders in developing the Outer Space Treaty were the United States, the Soviet Union, now Russia, and the United Kingdom. But despite efforts that have been going on for decades, I mean, the International Space Station is representative of how we should look at space internationally and peacefully. There's been a big erosion in recent times in that. And what you're describing, a break between the United States now and Russia on space, particularly with the Space Force proposal, I think easily could be in the offing.
Yeah, let's talk about what a Space Force is. Well, it sounds like a dystopian future, but it's actually the present. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what President Trump has said is that not only should we be in space, but we should dominate space, dominate. I think that does not represent, again, the spirit of the Outer Space Treaty and the spirit of peaceful uses in outer space. And if he thinks that Russia and China are not going to respond very aggressively to the U.S. attempting to dominate space, I mean, he's frankly delusional. Indeed, there's been a treaty proposed, this goes back for years, called the Paros Treaty, or the Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space Treaty. It would be an extension, an addition to the this original Outer Space Treaty, which precludes weapons of mass destruction in space. The Paros Treaty would ban all weapons in space and truly keep space a place for peace. The nations that have been promoting and pushing the Paros Treaty have been Canada, our neighbor Canada, Russia, and China. And the country which has been, and I've seen this in action, voting against enactment of the Paros Treaty at the United Nations, has been the United States. Now, it's kind of been an up-and-down situation. Obama didn't want weapons in space. On the other hand, the Bushes were kind of interested in military activity in space and so forth. Now, with Trump, we have something beyond the Bushes, a complete break, of course, from the Obama administration, because it's not just a matter of not voting for Paros. It's moving ahead on the weaponization of space. And let me note, I have a book called Weapons in Space, goes back a number of years. When you're speaking about weapons in space, you're speaking about nuclear-powered weapons in space, the kind of hypervelocity guns and particle beams and laser weapons that were, well, they originally proposed under Reagan's Star Wars program and are still cooking. They need a lot of power, lasers and hypervelocity guns and particle beams, and the plan has been to have orbiting battle platforms in space energized by nuclear reactors. And those nuclear reactors would provide the energy. In fact, the commander of the Strategic Defense Initiative, as it was called at one point, General Christensen, said, like, without nuclear in space, we're going to have a long extension cord reaching down to Earth. So what we're speaking about when Trump talks about dominating space, the U.S. dominating space, is one, battle platforms up in space with nuclear reactors on them. Imagine if there'd be a shooting war with all that nuclear stuff up in space. And secondly, and this is so important, a turn, a change from China and Russia, from being for an extension of the Outer Space Treaty to, well, meeting the U.S. in kind and saying, the hell with space for peace, we're going to prepare for war in space too. It would open the heavens to war, and it would be just a terrible thing.
Carl Grossman, Professor Carl Grossman, is our guest. Carl Grossman is an expert on the militarization of outer space, nukes in outer space, nuclear energy in outer space. He's written 5 books. Professor Grossman, I'm looking at a December 3rd, 2018 article on National Public Radio. It's about a month ago. Soyuz rocket launches dock successfully to the relief of NASA and the Russian Space Agency. There's a picture of 3 astronauts, a NASA astronaut Anne McLean, Russian cosmonaut Oleg Kononenko, and David Saint-Jacques of the Canadian Space Agency successfully blasted into space on Monday morning. It is the first mission since an aborted launch in October. The United States and Canada and Russia are cooperating in sending human beings to staff the International Space Station.
And that leads to another question. You know, the head of the Russian Space Agency tweeted that perhaps American astronauts should use a trampoline from now on to get to the space station. So how would they get to the space station if this tit leads to a tat?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing is, like, in the current political climate where the U.S. has now revamped its national security doctrine, targeting major power conflict or competition as the priority, not the war on terrorism, not counterterrorism, but conflict with Russia and China. Then you have these, you know, Yahoo senators and Congress people saying, how dare you invite the head of the Russian Space Agency to come and meet? And so the NASA capitulates. The guy who capitulated, the head of NASA, he'll probably be fired for having invited him. I mean, we're in an atmosphere, Carl Grossman, of a political sort of hysteria, even though it's worse than it was in a way in the 1960s, where there was these agreements to cooperate in outer space. And yet, when you look at the real contest in global politics, it's not like Russia is supporting the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laotians and the South Africans and the Nicaraguans and El Salvadorans and Cubans in some armed struggle, revolutionary process against the United States. It seems to be sort of unworldly. It has its own life. And I wonder if this isn't just a manufactured sort of hysteria for the benefit of those who want to keep pumping more and more and more money into arms manufacturing, either for ground war or war in outer space.
Well, absolutely. In terms, you're talking here about corporate influence, the lobbying for the militarization of space, and NASA losing its way, truly, under corporate and political pressure. But let me note, I've been to Russia numerous times, speaking around the country on issues involving space and nuclear power and environmental issues. I was invited to Russia originally by the late, just died a few months ago, Alexei Yablokov, who was the environmental advisor to Yeltsin and to Gorbachev. And he was very concerned. That's why he invited me, because of the use of nuclear power by the Soviet Union. And he knew of my writings in this regard. And I've been to China, and I was speaking to Chinese diplomats, and their position has been, like, let's go to China first. We don't want to expend money on warfare in space. We want to feed our people. We want to house our people, and so forth and so on. And in Russia, there's a kind of a division, but a lot of folks I met members of the Duma and so forth, feel that Alexei Yablokov was correct, that we, in terms of Russia, must keep to this ideal, this vision of peaceful uses of outer space and nations working together. Now when you see, this Russian space official being disinvited, when you see for years after the end of the shuttle program, the U.S. went up, had our astronauts go up to the space station on Soyuz rockets, on Russian rockets. That's ended, and now SpaceX is talking about, in fact, is moving ahead on providing U.S. transportation, U.S. itself, to the space station, which is probably should have been done, period. We shouldn't be dependent on anybody. But the vision, the goal of international cooperation when it comes to space seems to be falling apart. And as I say, Trump's push for a space force, that just ups the ante in terms of the prospects of war in space many, many degrees.
John, Carl Grossman is right. If one side, and it could be either side, in this case it's Trump and the space force, if one side takes a step to escalate or to get rid of the provisos that make space peaceful, in other words, if they start to militarize outer space, the other side responds. It's tit for tat.
They would have to.
You climb the escalation ladder. And so what do we have then? What kind of world do we want? Do we want a world where when we look into the heavens, we're going to see it filled with weapons that have the capacity to eliminate not only the, quote, enemy, but really life on the planet? And again, how do you stop this? Climbing an escalation ladder is easy, almost impossible under these circumstances to get off that ladder.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Unfortunately, we were joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.